Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, great blessings, and welcome to another installment of The Gist of Freedom is Faith. My name is R. Lee Gordon of Unity Design and the National Black Teen Empowerment Expo. And as everyone knows, my calling is to prove that Black America has all the necessary resources to improve the quality of life and learning for our young generation. As always, this show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author Leslie Gist Etheridge, and serves as a weekly live online discussion that celebrates the African-American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who are, through faith and focus, preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. As always, we want to thank you for joining us tonight and welcome you to the show and encouraging you to be a part of our discussion. Please feel free to call in with your comments. That number is 347-324-5552. Again, if you'd like to be a part of tonight's discussion, you can call into the show by dialing 347-324-5552. Now, we have a special holiday treat and a very, special guest. Tonight we are welcoming a powerful young man with an inspiring story who's uplifting all of our children in realizing their greatness by imparting and sharing with them a greater understanding of their history. Welcome to the show, Brother Jamal Brown.
Greetings, greetings. How you doing today, good brother?
I'm always well, thank you. How are you?
Doing fantastic here in sunny, yet wet, well, typically sunny, but very wet right now, Southern California, just indoor trying to stay warm.
Okay. Well, we don't even want to hear about sunshine this time of year being East Coasters, Leslie and me. You know, we got our ear on the radio, but our butts on the radiator, so you know, we're trying to get through it and, you know, this is indeed the season to be indoors celebrating time with family and friends and faith. You are one of the most powerful young men that I've had an opportunity to befriend in recent memory. I know that you are a motivational speaker. You are an entrepreneur. You are a creator of the 365 days of Black Facts calendar, which is, again, just a marvelous tool that we all can use to share with our children a greater understanding of our history, heritage, and culture, all the broad shoulders that we stand upon, and realizing how powerful we are, not just in this country, but globally, through our contributions to the betterment of man and society. Brother Brown, let's start off from the beginning, because you have a very interesting personal story as to why you are now the man that you are today. And so I'd like you to share with our listeners a little bit more about Jamal Brown, the man, before we go into Jamal Brown, the creator of so many other things and inspirer of so many other things.
Okay, not a problem. As I mentioned earlier, I'm here in Southern California. This is the only place I've ever called home. And growing up, I saw limited opportunities for African-American people. It was about the fourth, maybe the fifth grade, when a teacher gave the assignment to the class to go home, sit down and think about what they wanted to do, and come back with a list of five things that they wanted to do, or, you know, thought that they would utilize for fame and fortune. I went home like a diligent student, sat down, looked deeply inside of my family, looked at the families of the friends that were around me, looked at television that night, you know, particularly the news, and sort of began cataloging the things that I saw African-American people doing. And I didn't make a list of five. My list only consisted of four things. And the four things I put on my list that I thought that I would do would either be an athlete, a drug dealer, a gang member, or an entertainer. In my heart of hearts, I saw those possibilities being the only possibilities for the majority of my people, that again being an athlete, drug dealer, gang member, and entertainer. Throughout the years, I've put varying levels of interest and energy into each of those four categories. One story I like to tell is how I was so convinced that I was going to be a drug dealer that I actually one Sunday morning decided to tell my mom of my future endeavors. She was in the kitchen washing dishes, a handful of palm olive soap, I always like to say the green kind, and sat down at the bar stool in front of her and said, "Hey, Mom, I found out what I want to do." Like any good mother, you know, astute and in tune with their children, child in this case, she said, "Hey, baby, you know, tell me all about it." Said, "Just like Dwight, the guy that lives up the street, he's a good guy. I'm going to sell drugs." My mother's one of those still waters run deep type of women, you know, never too much emotion on the surface, and she stayed in form, kept her head down, continued to wash those dishes. That's when I got real scared. They say, you know, when a black woman's quiet, you know, something bound to go down. And so I just sat there, total silence. Had to probably be about a minute, which felt like a year, before she spoke. She lifted up her head and said, "Baby, I don't think that's going to work out too well for you." I said, "Why not?" I said, "Why not?" She says, "After I beat you, I'm calling the police on you, and you're going to jail." And so I scratched that off the list, entertained the thought of being a gang member as well. However, I couldn't exactly find out what a gang member does when he's not killing somebody. You know, even the most ardent killer takes a kill break every now and again. And I couldn't quite feel or figure out, again, what constructive things gang members did. Plus, figure, you know, there's no gang 401K, no stock options, retirement plans, nothing of that nature. Certainly, additionally, my father had been shot, and so I had had a pretty good secondhand view of what a bullet can do to flesh, and so I decided that I really didn't need any bullets in my life, and so I scratched that off the list as well. I eventually put all my eggs into the athletics basket. Day and night, night and day, I was playing basketball. If I wasn't playing basketball, I was certainly thinking about basketball. If I wasn't thinking about basketball, certainly I was asleep. That is how much basketball was intertwined in my life. All was going well. I transferred schools when I got to high school so I can get some more notoriety at this particular school. I was captain of the team. All was well until one day I wasn't feeling too well. Mom was there again, took me to the doctor. They ran a litany of tests. Doctor eventually came back and said, "Mr. Brown, you have apical hypertrophic myocardiopathy." I said, "Could you say that in English, please?" He says, "You have apical hypertrophic myocardiopathy. The tip of your heart is about 2 times thicker than it should be, and we're not sure that blood can flow to all the facets of your heart. I've scheduled you a heart surgery in 2 weeks. So at the age of 13, I literally went from a basketball table to an operating table where I had to undergo heart surgery. Immediately upon waking up from surgery, my first words were, "When can I play basketball again?" The doctor looked at me sadly and said, "Mr. Brown, the surgery was unsuccessful, and I will never again sign the waiver for you to play basketball." This set of circumstances would be depressing, to say the least, to anyone, but they were doubly depressing to me because at this point my entire list was gone. My athlete, drug dealer, gang member, entertainer list was gone, and so I saw little hope for myself at that point. However, I realized that my mind was strong, and as Les Brown says, I realized that if I can look up, then I can get up. It was at that point where I began picking up books on African-American history, and something miraculous happened inside of my mind. I realized that we were more than just athletes, drug dealers, gang members, and entertainers, yet we were the mothers and fathers of civilization, the world's first doctors, first lawyers, first politicians, first mathematicians, the first to create institutions of higher learning where people came from all over the globe to study our information. This is who I descended from, and it was at that point that I began using the same energy that I used to use on the basketball court in my studies outside of school and in my studies in school. And I went on to become my high school's first ever African-American valedictorian. I received about $50,000 in scholarships, accepted to 8 universities, some of the most prestigious universities in the nation, and eventually accepted a full academic scholarship to a local college here at California State University, Long Beach, where I received my degree in business. And so that's a pretty good backdrop on the man, as you would say.
Mm-hmm. And what was your inspiration into developing this incredible 365 days of Black Facts calendar?
Yes, the Black 365.us calendar, found at www.black365.us. It really, to be 100% honest, started out as a personal project. I had all these fabulous individuals, instances, and ideas in Black history cataloged in my mind, and so I just sort of began putting them in chronological order as the year progresses, and noticed I had a few holes or what have you, and so I began to fill in those holes. And I showed a few people, and they sort of said, "Hey, this is something special. You got something here." And it fully goes in line with who I am. I mean, Brother Arley, each morning I wake up and say that affirmation that I just said a few minutes ago. I'm a descendant of the mothers and fathers of civilization, the world's first doctors, first lawyers, first. I say that to myself. Additionally, as I, you know, say my prayers and my feet hit the floor, I ask myself, how can I inspire, uplift, and encourage someone today through Black history, letting them know that that we're more than just athletes, drug dealers, gang members, entertainers. I want to eliminate that list or completely dispel that negative rumor that creeps inside the minds of too many of our youth. So, again, I wake up every morning trying to inspire, uplift, and encourage. And, again, that gave me the energy necessary to complete the arduous task, the labor of love, as I like to say, and that being the creation of the 365 Days of Black Facts calendar.
Well, you know what's amazing? I mean, at the age of 13, it seems that despite negative personal circumstances in your life, you were at the same time given this light that came through as a beacon and allowed you to clearly command your future and clearly understand the path for which you were meant.
Mm-hmm.
We already have some callers. We're going to get to you in a few. We appreciate your patience. What I'd like to know is which books influenced you. I know that we've spoken in the past. I know that the autobiography of Malcolm X is one of the books that inspired you. What other books would you recommend for our young people? And I would then want to talk with you about the effect of your calendar on young people.
Okay. Awesome. More so than books, if you don't mind, I'd rather just shout out maybe a few authors and say pretty much everything by them. First and foremost, in depth, this man has taught me more than anyone in life about myself and African-American history, African history worldwide, and that being none other than Dr. John Henrik Clark. John Henrik Clark, H-E-N-R-I-K-C-L-A-R-K. RKE, if I'm not mistaken, John Turner Clark. Virtually every book, I believe there's over 100 that he's either written or edited. Everything from this man has inspired me and given me invaluable knowledge and information about myself and our past. Another brother who's still living, Dr. Ben Jokinen. I can't pronounce his last name properly, but you can just look him up, Dr. Ben, as he's affectionately known. Everything by that brother, too, is truly, truly outstanding. Tony Browder is another person. Two of his books I picked up early, very early on in my development. I believe one is called From the Browder Files, like 22 Essays and African-American Experience. Again, Tony Browder, another author. So those three.
Okay, well, let's take it from the top.
Uh-huh.
What are one or two books by John Henry Clark that you would recommend to our youth or even adults?
Got it. He has a book. I'm looking for it here on my bookshelf and in between my books. The one about Columbus. The title escapes me at this exact moment. But something with regards to Columbus, another one.
Okay.
The titles are escaping me right now. But
okay,
yeah.
Don't worry about it. I didn't mean to put you on the spot, bro.
No problem.
Let's talk about the calendar. Now, each day you dedicate to a particular Black history item. Either someone was born on that day who has played a role in our history, something happened on that day that played a role in our history. Share with our listeners a little bit more about the 365 Days of Black Facts calendar.
Certainly, 365 Days of Black Facts calendar, again, highlights an individual or instance or accomplishment, an invention that someone of African descent has done around the world. So it highlights something inspiring and uplifting that people can take from and hopefully be blessed by and move forward by. It just gives a highlight or a snippet. The thought behind that is, you know, hopefully people will go. Everyone has a birthday, so start out with your birthday. Pick that day, you know, and then perhaps Google it, get some other resources and references about that, and learn more about, you know, the day that you were born and the significance of the events that have taken place on that particular day.
Okay. Now, we know that we are granted 1 month a year as a country to share with children of all colors and cultures more about our illustrious history, which I think is a disservice just in that context. We know that there are some more popular items of our history that most of us know about in this country. What we'd like to do is we'd like to have you share with our listeners, if you would, some of the lesser known but just as important and inspiring facts regarding contributors to Black history that, again, may not be quite as widespread.
Okay. Certainly. The month, each month of the calendar, at the top of the calendar, is an individual in about two or three sentences highlighting them. So, for example, the month of July, there's the brother Alexander Dumas. Alexander Dumas, his father was born in Haiti. His mother was French. So by all, you know, brother was a brother. He has an afro, most pictures I've ever seen of him. This brother is responsible for the creation of the Count of Monte Cristo, the Three Musketeers, and the Nutcracker. Now, you know, during this holiday season, a bunch of us are headed to the theaters, and I'm sure it comes on television, animated form, theatrical form, all the like, the Nutcracker. But lo and behold, you know, a brother with an afro is the person responsible for pinning that. And
wow.
To give you some real-life circumstance in which this power, this information can be used as power, I take my son, he's 8 years old, I take him to the library every Thursday where there's a chess club. So this past Thursday we were there, a couple of young brothers sitting around me playing chess, and one of the brothers somehow the topic of Haiti, the name Haiti, came out of someone's mouth. And you know, one brother said, "Hey, what is Haiti?" Another brother answered, "Oh, that's the earthquake country." Said, "Young brother, how about you take a look at this calendar? In the calendar, we see the very first fact in the calendar." Let me read it verbatim here. January 1 says, "The island of Haiti became the first African-led nation in the world as a result of revolution, 1804. And so I say, as opposed to saying Haiti, the earthquake country, why don't you say Haiti, the home of some revolutionaries that look just like me? How about you say Haiti, the home of Alexander Dumas, the brother who created the Nutcracker, Count of Monte Cristo, and Three Musketeers?" And so he said, you know, the brother just looked at me in amazement, you know, flipped through the calendar at a feverish place, you know, shouting out his birthday, his mother's birthday, all sorts of things. And he said, "You know what, from now on, whenever I hear Haiti, I'm going to think of Haiti as the place where revolutionaries who look just like me came from."
There you go. And that's imparting upon our youth a little broader perspective than that which they're getting in school and, unfortunately, not often enough in the home. And let me just put it out there, too. Would encourage our listeners to go to blogtalkradio.com, the Antique E-Show, where Leslie Gist Etheridge has put together this very profound, powerful slide presentation that highlights many historic figures, and everyone should take a look at this if you get a chance. Again, that's blogtalkradio.com, the Antique E Show. Check out this incredible slideshow that Leslie did a wonderful job on. Okay, so let's think. We talked January, we talked Haiti. Let's get back into some of those lesser-known facts of great significance in our history, Jamal.
Got it. Let's take a look here. Well, one of my favorites, Sister Sarah Breedlove, a.k.a. Madam C.J. Walker. It's a bit of a misnomer. Some people know her or know of her name. Some people say she created the hot comb. That actually is a bit of a misnomer. She did not create the hot comb. However, she did make some modifications to what we currently call the hot comb. And the more important thing about her is that she was this country's first self-made woman millionaire of any color,
right?
Black, white, Asian, Latino, first self-made woman millionaire. She had a number of cosmetic products used to strengthen hair and regrow hair, what have you. You got to understand, this was at a time when sisters worked in the field from can't see in the morning to can't see at night, you know, is what she said. When, you know, they oftentimes had their hair wrapped in handkerchiefs, you know, and got so all sorts of diseases and ailments and breaking of hair. And so she developed a number of cosmetic products that were sold door-to-door by Walker agents. So a lot of us know, so all of us in these multi-level marketing things, Mary Kay, Avon, and what have you, going door-to-door, selling, what have you. She actually was the architect of some of those compensation models and things where people would go door-to-door and have, you know, people under them selling and all that sorts of stuff. So Sarah Breedlove, U.S.'s first woman self-made millionaire, looks just like you and me.
And she owned movie theaters, apartment buildings, was a
major philanthropist,
spearheaded and supported several social organizations.
The UNIA, Marcus Garvey's movement, yes.
There you go. United Negro Improvement Association.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful, beautiful. You know, one of the things I'd like to ask you is, I have been a student of youth advocacy. I have spent a good portion of my adult life really looking at some of the challenges that our children are facing. And recently I read some very disturbing, startling research about the fact that there is an increased rate of suicides among young black males in this country.
Very true.
And it really disturbed me. But one of the things that they attributed it to was what I call a hole in the soul, or void of self-identity, which sort of led to lesser self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
I would like you to share with our listeners, if you would, how a greater understanding of our history has impacted the youth who you have engaged and worked with through your motivational speaking and you just being a brother who's out there connecting with our children.
Certainly, certainly. As you mentioned, a hole in the soul is something very powerful. I mean, words can almost not even begin to describe the lifelessness many young brothers and sisters have throughout this country. And they have it as a result of thinking that they themselves are insignificant and cannot impact the world because they come from people who are insignificant and have not impacted the world. You know, when they do not see any sorts of vibrant or positive roles or anything in history
role
that
model.
Role models, right. Thank you, roles role and role models, models. Heroes and sheroes, that's what I was looking for, heroes and sheroes, roles and role models that look like them, again, you feel as if you have no roots, you have no foundation. And so what I have seen real life in front of my eyes as a result of the calendar, as a result of some of the speaking and stuff that I do, is that people, young men and women, the testimonies I hear from their parents later is that they begin to, you know, stick their chest out a little bit more when they hear and see, you know, oftentimes myself, you know, young African-American man doing something positive, and, again, hear and see these heroes and sheroes in history that have contributed not only to black history but to world history, you know, and they see that we've had an impact all around the globe. There's stoplights because a black man created a stoplight. There's the automatic gear shift in cars all around the world because there was a black man who created the automatic gear shift for cars. There are street sweepers all around the world because of the black man, James Brooks, who created the street sweeper. And so once they see that we have had a significant role in world history, a positive impact in world history, they too begin asking themselves, much as I ask myself, what will be my legacy and how will the world know me? I had a fantastic testimonial from a grandmother not that long ago where she said her grandson is a biracial individual. He's white, mixed white and black. And he knew much about his white side, but knew very little about his black side. And the teacher gave the class an assignment to do a book report and said that they can choose any book report they want. And the young brother went to the calendar, found his birthday, found out what happened on it, went to Google, you know, and put together a fantastic report, eventually got an A on that report. And the grandmother says, the kitchen used to be the home of the calendar. The calendar now resides in his bedroom next to his bed where he flips through it each night. And so, again, real-life applicable things can and have been, you know, going on with this information presented here.
And, if, you know, in many ways it is an affirmation as to our legacy, our greatness, and the greatness that we should know our children are destined for by better understanding that history, that heritage, our history, our heritage. Jamal, we have a few minutes left. I'd like to give you final words. Please, number one, share with our listeners, if you would. Your website is black365.us, correct?
That is correct, www.black365.us.
Okay, and we can get them calendars in time for Christmas, so they do make the perfect gift, correct?
That is correct. That is correct.
I'd also like to share with our listeners that Jamal is available as a motivational speaker. If you want more information about this young man, I believe you can also visit jamalbrown.com. Are you comfortable sharing a phone number for people to reach you?
Not a problem, not a problem. Let me give you the proper spelling of jamalbrown.com. It's a little bit unique, J-A-M-A-A-L. Brown.com there for the URL for my direct website. And they can contact me at 661-609-8193. Again, area code 661-609-8193. They can get me there.
Jamal, thank you so much for joining us. I just want to quickly share with our listeners that you and I are working on a collaboration that is dedicated to sharing more of our history and heritage with our young people. On a national scale, people will be hearing more about the Inspire Project in days ahead. Thank you so much, Jamal, for joining us. Before we go, however, we are going to ask Leslie to share a little bit about Christmas based on the research of Alex Haley. Leslie, are we ready to go with that snippet? Okay. Sometimes technology can be as fickle as kinfolk. Jamal, stay with us for a second. We may just wrap this up if we're not ready for the snippet. And but before we do, is there a caller with a 661 area code on the line? 661, are you there?
That may have been me.
Oh, that's you. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, again, we're a little bit thrown off here. Leslie, do you want to go ahead with that Alex Haley snippet about Christmas?
The log of any ship of any kind, which at any time between April and September 1766 had been in my strip of ocean. And I knew one thing, having been an old sailor and having done a lot of work in old ship records, that in the days of sailing ship, every time they change the watch on a ship, they record the longitude and the latitude and the weather. And whenever I'd find in any of these logs a ship that had been in my strip of ocean in those months, I would pluck out the longitude, latitude, and with my little stuff I could pinpoint where she was when she made a specific weather reading, and I could reduce that weather reading to the symbols. And in that way, 3 weeks about, I had 411 weather readings scattered over that strip of ocean. I went back to Bracknell and got two lieutenant commanders, Royal Navy, and showed it to them, and they became engrossed with it. It was like a double cross-stitch puzzle. And then they went in with colleagues, and with the modern weather prognosis methods, they were able to recreate the weather in which the Lord Ligonier had sailed. I found that the reason she had dropped anchor was a very valid one. She'd been coming out of Gravesend, and the weather had been getting worse on her, and she came to that point where you have to make a starboard turn, and where they needed east in the wind to make that turn safely. But the wind had shifted to southwest. She had to drop the anchor, because if she hadn't, she would have been in danger of drifting over into an area called the Goodwin Sands. And she laid in there waiting for the wind to shift. And she waited and waited until finally it was July 5th, 1766. She was in 8 fathoms of water. It was a Tuesday morning. The millibar reading was 10:10. The weather was a drizzle becoming fair, and the wind shifted east-northeast. And that was the day she ran up the sails. She went on down now past Shakespeare Cliff, past the White Cliffs of Dover, Dungeness, Beale Head, down to Lizard's Head, and into the open sea. She went southeasterly across the Bay of Biscay, down to the Cape Verdes, the Canaries, and then she made the bend upwards and came up to the Gambia River. She would spend the next 10 months in that Gambia River slaving. At the end of 10 months, she had a cargo, 3,265 elephant's teeth, as they called ivory tusks, 3,700 pounds of beeswax, 800 pounds of raw cotton, 32 ounces of gold, 140 Africans. And with that cargo, she set sail July 5th, 1767. It was a Sunday. She sailed directly to Annapolis. She arrived in Annapolis, and when she got in there, I knew of her coming in there because I went now to Annapolis, and I went into one set of records that you can generally find back to the time of Christ, and that's tax records, to find out what had she declared for tax when she got in there. The captain was very honest. He declared everything that he declared on leaving the fort in the Gambia River, the James Fort, whose ruins I had seen. He now declared in Annapolis everything there, but the original 140 Africans had become 98 who had survived the voyage, which was about average for slave ships. Another little interesting side thing I happened to sort of stumble upon in the course of the research was that percentage-wise, more whites, crew, died on slave ships than slaves did. The Lord Ligonier would bear it out. She had left England with a full crew of 36, and she arrived in Annapolis with 18 of them alive. At that time, I knew that if you had cargo as valuable as slaves to sell, then as now, one would advertise. And I went now looking for the records of the media of the day. I went into the microfilm records of the Maryland Gazette, the issue of October 1st, 1767, Page 3, the far left column, the third ad down, there was the Lord Ligonier's ad, placed by its agents, that she had, quote, just arrived from the River Gambia with fresh slaves to be sold the following Wednesday. And then that auction was held. Now I had one thing left to pin down beyond any question, that the miracle indeed had been achieved through the help of God. That's the only way I can feel about it. I had to be able to pin down that without question that was the same African I'd heard about. And my clue now went back to the front porch in Henning, Tennessee, that always Grandma and Aunt Liz and Cousin George and Aunt Plus and Aunt Viney and all of them would talk about this African always had rejected the name Toby, which he had been given by his master. And I knew that they had always said that Massa John Waller bought him off the ship, and later, after his foot had been cut off, Massa William Waller, the brother of John, had bought him from his brother. It was oral history kept down across generations of a black family in America. And I had had things now which tended to make me put great reliance in what Grandma had said. I didn't doubt it at all anymore, but the thing was try and document it. I went now to Richmond, Virginia, and got again into that experience of working in that world of the old-fashioned handwriting, the F's like S's. I'm working now in the longhand legal deeds of the 1760s, Spotsylvania County, Virginia. And I searched and searched and searched, and I believe it was in the fourth week that I found what I had been looking for. There it was, a deed dated September 5th, 1768. Kunta Kinte, by that time, would have been 11 months in this country, a colonial America. And there was the deed, Spotsylvania County, Virginia, between William Waller on the one part and John Waller and his wife on the other, transferring from John and his wife Ann to William goods. The first page dealt with the transfer of 240 odd acres of land, the fences and other things on that land. And then on the second page, I think it was about the fifth line down, between two commas, were the words, quote, and also one Negro man slave named Toby. And that brought it full circle. There was no question. It was gulpy. It was my God time. The rest of the research, I could stand up here 6 hours, I guess, and talk, but I'm not going to do that. It would just be telling about what happened in the way of the research, the drama, the adventure of it, across 9 years, finally to flesh out the book that took another 3 years to write, the book called Roots. I learned, I've tried to share with people a lot about the history of black people. And when I got myself very aware of the history of black people, I began to reflect upon how little I had known at the outset, what a hoax I felt had been pulled on me by many forces, that I had gotten to be a grown man and knew next to nothing about my own people, that all I had known about Africa, the ancestral culture of us, had, as I say, been drawn from Tarzan, Jungle Jim sort of things, and that I knew little about slavery, really. And then I got to reflecting that if this had been the case with me, what did I know about other people? And I just got curious, me black, but me human being, about other peoples. So what I began to do was just for me to go into the libraries, with which I'm pretty familiar by now, and just do a little peripheral study about virtually every ethnic group of the peoples who comprise the population of this United States of America. And what I begin to discover, and what collectively I know has enriched me as few things I have, at least so I feel, is that it does not matter who they are, from whence they came, But every single ethnic group in this country, if you go back and you study and you know about that group of people in whatever was their old country, their trials, their problems, their tribulations, their frustrations, in some cases persecutions, if you know about the hope, the beacon that America represented, about the time they came to the immigrant generation, and then the generation that got here and assimilated, that what you deal with every ethnic group on the face of this country, is a thrilling, stirring human drama in this nation of immigrants, in which black people happen to be the only unwilling immigrants. None of us ever must forget that blacks were the only ones who came here in chattel slave status and in chains in this nation of immigrants. And then I reflected about how it seems to me that all of us, every one of us, it does not matter who, have a stake in something that I thought to be one of the most stirring, moving, dramatic, heartrending things I came upon in the study of the culture of Africa for the book Roots. And that was the thing that had to do with how the babies were named. In this land that we have all heard about as heathens and savages peopling it, that in this land, 200, 300, 400 years ago, in any little village, when a baby was born, the people of the village would not see much of the father for 7 days because he was occupied with going about, keeping pretty much to himself, thinking up a good, meaningful, significant name for this infant. And bear in mind, these are these heathens and savages we've heard so much about, and that these babies are the ancestors of we black people here today. On the 8th day, the people of the village would gather at that particular little circular mud-walled home with the thatched roof. And there would be a stool sitting just outside. The people brought with them, in the Mandinka culture anyway, a jollibar, a drummer, who brought a cylindrical drum called the tantang. And then they had another man there who was the equivalent of our minister. They called him the alemamo. And the jollibar would give a roll on his drum, and the people would stand rigidly at attention. A second roll on the drum, and the mother, who had been inside waiting for that signal, now would step out and sit herself on this stool, holding the little 8-day-old black infant, these heathens and savages. The third roll on the drum, and the alemamo would step forth and bless the gathering, because this had happened to everybody there when they were 8 days of age. And then the next roll, the father, would come from the bush. He was waiting somewhere just for this signal. And now this father would walk over with every eye on him, his fellow villagers, his neighbors, his tribesmen, and he would walk over to where the mother sat holding this little 8-day-old infant. And the father now would bend, and he would lift up this infant, and he would turn it so that one of its ears was very close to his lips. And into that tiny ear, that father would whisper the name he had selected 3 times. And the thinking of these alleged heathens and savages in doing it this way was that the individual thus named always would be the first to know who he was. Those are the ancestors of us as a people. And it seems to me that the symbolism for us all, having nothing to do with our race, whatever race we may be, but just us people as human beings, it seems to me the potential of us and the symbol for us is contained in the second part of the baby naming ceremony. And that was that night when the father, now alone, would take his infant a distance away from the village, and he would hold it up so that its face, its eyes, looked up toward the firmament, the stars and the moon. And the father would speak to his infant, again, the symbol for us all and our potentials, the quote, "Behold the only thing greater than thyself." Thank you.
Given, let's see that we